The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Empowerment Channel. For more information about our network and to check out additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericaempowerment.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
The following program may contain detailed testimonials of domestic violence, childhood sexual abuse, rape, and/or psychological abuse. If you experience a trigger while listening to this broadcast, please visit the links on our host page for helpful resources. If you or somebody you know has experienced domestic violence or psychological or sexual abuse, the next hour could be the most important one this week. This is Abuse Survival Stories presents I Reclaim My Voice with your hosts, Reese Zigazaga and Denise Watkus. Our program features survivors that share their stories of abuse and the healing journey. Join us as we work toward ending the silence on which abuse thrives. Now, here are your hosts.
You're a real man with the heart of an imaginary character. So what does it really beat for? You would trade simple moments of happiness for complex apartments you'd never get the keys to because of simple numbers you can't count on. Far is too close, and close is always too far. The sky always looks at you, and you never look into the sky. That will cause you to stretch your throat and massage some words that will speak volumes too loud for small speakers. This explains the men in her circle that blame their lack of energy on love. They claim it makes them weak and unable to think for themselves.
Hello and welcome to Abuse Survival Stories presents I Reclaim My Voice. I'm your host, Reese Zigazaga.
And I'm your host, your co-host, Denise Watkus.
You just heard a clip from a poem called Circles by a very talented poet named Om Shanti. We'll play the full poem for you at the end of the show. Two awesome men are joining us today. The first is Jeff Pereira from the White Ribbon Campaign, which is the world's largest organization of men working with men to end violence against women. And later in the show, we'll be talking to Glenn Canning. Glenn is the father of Retea Parsons, who took her own life after experiencing sexual violence and cyber harassment. It's so important to us that we include men in the discussion of abuse, and we're so glad to have both of these men on the show.
Absolutely, Reese. Just before we get started, I wanted to apologize in advance to our listeners and our guests for my voice sounding a little rougher than usual. I'm battling a bug, but I did not want to miss this wonderful opportunity to speak with our brilliant and inspiring guests this evening, the first of which is Mr. Jeff Pereira. As Reese mentioned, Jeff is the community engagement manager for White Ribbon, the world's largest movement of men and boys working to end violence against women and girls, promote gender equity, and a new vision of masculinity. He curates the annual What Makes a Man conference and organized the first TEDx Women's event in Toronto. Jeff has also delivered two TEDx talks, including The Ladder of Manhood. Jeff, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor to be here.
Thank you
so much. So, Jeff, can you share with our listeners a bit more about what you do as a community engagement manager for White Ribbon?
Absolutely. So I'm really, in this day and age, I'm very thankful to have an opportunity as part of my full-time work to go into the community and working with men, young men, and boys of all different ages, different walks of life, and sharing with them my story and the message of White Ribbon, which is how we can play a role in making a difference, how men and boys can inspire one another to embrace healthy ideas of manhood and the roles we play and can play in ending gender-based violence here and across the world. And that can take place in our spaces where we navigate, spaces where we work, live, worship, and study, hang out. And it's really my job is I'm very lucky to be able to go and deliver workshops, talks, sessions, help with projects that we are running, and as mentioned, help organize a conference we do every year to kind of continue these conversations and have discussions around these topics and how we can work to make a difference.
That is awesome. Now, Jeff, I'm not sure if you listened, but in our very first show, Reese and I discussed what stood out to us the most out of all the Abuse Survival Stories events so far. Mm. And my answer was, when you came and spoke, there was a part of a poem that you recited, and just paraphrasing, but the part that stood out to me the most was when you said, young girls are given dolls so that they can practice taking care of others before they even know how to take care of themselves. Can you explain the dangers of that and how it ties into the light that women are seen by some men and society as a whole?
Well, you know, the way we raise young boys and young girls across the world, not to generalize, but there's a lot of common themes in different spaces and places, and one of those things is we raise young boys to take chances and take risks, to go for it, you know, and the world is yours and that kind of thing. And what's great about that is it's important to assert ourselves in our lives. We need to assert ourselves and be confident and make things happen, and we learn from mistakes. So it's taking chances, right, taking risks. The problem with that is when we, you know, if we raise young people to take but not think about what will happen if someone else doesn't have, right? So it's, mm-hmm, it's mindfulness, being conscious of our surroundings. And we raise young girls in that way where, you know, the unfortunate thing is for young girls that at a certain point they're taught these things that are, again, stereotyping, but things like, you know, act like a lady, brush your hair, don't leave the house looking like that, mind your manners, don't speak up, be ladylike, all these different phrases and terms. And part of that is raising young girls to be very mindful of their situations and surroundings, because of this idea that they're conscious of, you know, what will people think of me and how will they look at me and interact with me. So, again, they are the other, on the other side of the spectrum, where a lot of them are raised to be very mindful of their surroundings and thinking of consequences of their actions, right? And not necessarily all young girls walking around in a state of fear, but it's that beginning of recognizing that the world is a different world for them. You know, and there's things that they have to go through, different realities that are invisible to a lot of men, things that they don't see. You know, for a lot of young boys, when they think of their first, that moment they went from childhood to adulthood, I mean, I remember for me it was when I was talking with my friends, I was probably, you know, 11, 12 years old, and talking about my Transformer dolls, you know, and we said, he said, yeah, but you don't play with yours anymore. I was like, oh, no, of course I don't. I remember going home and putting it on the shelf, being like, oh, I guess I don't do that anymore. You know, but for young girls, I mean, a friend of mine in the States has this story in Atlanta of being 11 years old and in a spring dress and running around in the mall and opening the door for somebody and recognizing that it was the local celebrity news person, like a weather person. Mm-hmm. And he looked back at her, but the look that he gave her was not one of that she was accustomed to. He was staring at her legs, and she recognized, oh, wow, this is a different look, and it's a gaze that, a stare that she unfortunately had to become accustomed to, and adjust, and it changed, you know, for her, recognizing, I guess I'm not a little girl anymore, and introducing her to a world that she has to navigate. So I think a lot of this is really, you know, for men and boys, part of this, the work that we try to do is get them to see the invisible and recognize what it means to be a woman in this world, what it's like for a young girl, and how we can help change that.
I can definitely relate to a lot of what you shared, and it's so interesting. I never considered that the transition from boyhood into manhood and girlhood into womanhood is so stark in comparison. It's really interesting. And in one of your TEDx talks, The Ladder of Manhood, you say, and I'm quoting, I ask you the question, is growing up for young men and men today an ascent or a descent into manhood? Can you talk about that a bit, Jeff?
Absolutely. You know, I think this is a conversation we really need to be present with today. It's, you know, thinking, what kind of man do you want to be, and what kind of man do you want the men and young men and boys in your life to be? And the analogy I use as a ladder of manhood is that there's a certain point where young men are introduced to this idea of being a man, and being a man is being tough, strong, being the solution, not the problem, having all the answers and not being weak, being strong, and all these different things. And it's this impossible, unattainable idea that they're going to spend the rest of their lives trying to achieve. And so I describe it as like a ladder they're trying to climb. And different people are at different stages of that ladder, depending on if they're a man of color, if they're an Aboriginal man, a trans man, a man with a disability. But the one thing we have in common is that we, unfortunately, are raised to use women and girls as the rungs on that ladder. You know, the way that we climb the ladder is using women and girls in our lives as instruments or tools, you know, to achieve this idea of manhood. And it's a rigged ladder that's set to fail one way or another and impact us all. So again, for me, it's recognizing what path are the young men and boys on in your life? Are they reaching a point of no return, you know, where, you know, there's certain things that start with the language that they're exposed to and attitudes and behaviors will then become their own attitudes and behaviors and the way they interact with people in their lives, and especially women and girls in their lives. And it's not really about, you know, it's not just about for heterosexual men, it's for of all genders. Mm-hmm. We devalue anything that's considered feminine. You know, there's a line that I use, and I talk about how these concepts, what we call patriarchy, this idea that the masculine is the dominant, and it's a very narrow idea of toxic masculinity. Mm-hmm. The phrase I use is that it's like a rope that's used as a choke chain that's used to kind of police young men into an idea of being a man, right? This narrow idea. We use that same rope to then suffocate anything that's deemed feminine.
Yes, right, so, and you mentioned that in the same TED Talk. You said the formula for manhood becomes prove you are not a woman. So why is this so problematic?
The problem with that is that, you know, we devalue anything that's deemed feminine. I mean, you know, there was a, in Canada, there was a hockey player that was describing his team, and he was using the language of, you know, we got to work harder, and we got to do better, and you can't, you know, we got to just try harder, and you can't be a girl about it. And half of the reaction was, well, you know, he's just a young player. He doesn't know what he's saying. I'm sure he didn't mean it. But the other half of the folks did recognize, no, this is, we need to, you know, think about what he said and recognize this is a representation of attitudes and values around what it means to be a girl, that it's an insult to be compared to, you know, and this idea of success is a masculine idea, unfortunately. And that's what it looks like on the field, in the locker room, in the boardroom, you know. So, for example, ideas of empathy and emotional intelligence and love, these are things that are human traits. But we raise, you know, we raise boys to think that those are feminine things,
yes,
to love someone, to care about someone, to nurture someone. So we devalue that, and that's seen as, like, lesser than. So it becomes very problematic because it leaves you as a guy, as a man, as a very half being, like disconnected from the full humanity of who you can be. Like to be a leader, so for example in a boardroom or in a workspace, to have empathy, emotional intelligence, that's powerful. That's powerful leadership,
yes,
traits, but it's devalued in that space. It's,
mm-hmm,
devalued in the streets. It's devalued, you know, in the locker room, etc. So not just those attitudes, but anyone who kind of wields those attitudes. So as a woman, if you're a woman that is about nurturing and love and empathy, you can become targeted for violence because that's not valued. It's devalued. And that's a huge problem. And it's something that we need to be honest about and, you know, start to really address.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. And Jeff, referring again to the ladder of manhood, mm-hmm, you spoke about a 13-year-old boy who stood up during one of your talks at a school. He was,
mm-hmm,
actually the friend of the shooter at the Eaton Center.
Mm-hmm.
And you were speaking to him, and he stood up and he said, you know, there is no hope. You know,
yeah,
based on your experience and in your opinion, has this been the consensus speaking with young men his age? And also, do you find that at the, you know, even if at the beginning they're feeling that way, at the end of the day, are they accepting or are they resistant towards the healthier ideas of masculinity that you present to them?
You know, it's really an important piece, right? Because a lot of times there's a phrase, you can't be what you don't see, right? And if you don't see another example, another idea of how I could be, how life could be, there is no hope, there is no idea until you recognize things can be different for myself and for those around me. But even when you come face to face with it, it can be hard to accept it, hard to accept change and hard to embrace that there's a different way to do things, especially when all you've seen your whole life is a certain ideal, a certain perspective on how to do things and how to be. But, you know, I can tell you that men and young men are hungry to have this conversation. they'll perform and pretend like they don't want to have it, etc. But a lot of that is because it's so close to home for them. They have to dismiss this conversation through laughter or playing it off as like, this is just like, you know, girly stuff or whatever it is. But it really is close to home to them because it's so much around them being able to be who they're meant to be, you know, having the freedom to be a better version of themselves. And I think that when young men are, they recognize and they see a different way that they can be, they want to embrace that. They just need to have the role models, positive role models. I mean, people aren't perfect. No one should be put on a pedestal, I think, right? It's about recognizing everyone's flawed, but there's certain people that we can look to and say, that's an example of how to do things differently. And that can make a huge difference. Like one person, it makes such a difference when one person has your back. You know, like if it's not a family member, if you don't have a parent who has your back, it's tough. But for these youth, when they have someone who believes in them and says, you know what, I know that you can rise above this, you can be different, and I see it in you. It's a huge thing to give that to someone, you know. So I think that we need to have more positive male role models. The phrase I use is more maps to manhood, more examples. Because there's no codes to this stuff, right? It's kind of like the first rule of being a guy is you don't talk about it, you just do it. You got to figure it out on your own, right? So you go by what the kids are doing in the neighborhood, what they're doing, you know, in your apartment building at school, and you go from there. And it's the movies you listen to, the music you listen to, and so we need more examples.
Definitely. And one of the other phrases that you use that I love so much is being a safe space. How can men become a safer space or safer spaces for women?
Yeah. Well, this is another thing that I think is so important. At White Ribbon, we really talk about this idea of embracing the impact you make and deciding to make it a positive one. You know, phrases like, it starts with you, it stays with him. These are programs that we run. And the idea of being a safer space, really briefly, is to recognize what that means. And that is, when you walk in the room, am I someone when I walk in the room, am I a walking safer space? You know, do I carry that with me? Because, you know, you can come to an event and Abuse Survival Story puts on some incredible events, and when people attend, they feel they're in a safer space, that they're heard, they're respected, they're valued, and they can be vulnerable. And the thing is that, you know, when you leave that room, that energy you might feel it leaves with everyone. It's not the physical space, it's what we create as people. So when I walk in the room, I want to be that person. I want to be that walking safer space. When I walk in the room, the guys in the room will know that I'm not going to stand for any sexist, misogynistic, violent attitudes or behavior or language, right? And the women in the room will know that I'm going to have their back, and also know that I'm someone that's going to believe them if they're going through something. And this is for men, too. It's because men, as we know, experience violence as well and are survivors of sexual, physical violence. And to know that when I walk in the room, you can come to me and talk to me, and I will believe you, and I will support you, and I'll have your back. Mm. That's a big piece. And we can carry that and share that, so then that person becomes a safer space. And when I say safer, I mean, that's the accountability piece. You can't just say, oh, well, I'm a good guy, and that's it. You got to show up every day. You got to do that every day. You got to prove. You got to walk the walk, talk the talk. You got to earn that every day. You know, I can't call myself a safer space. Someone's got to look at me and say, that's someone that's going to have my back, that's going to believe in me. You know, and I do that by my actions, not by my words. So.
Exactly. And for all of us, it's all about putting that love and that compassion into action. So it's absolutely amazing. Mm-hmm. We've come to a break. And when we come back, we'll talk with Jeff about White Ribbon's efforts to end violence against women. In the meantime, reach out to us on Twitter at @survivalofabuse using the hashtag #IReclaimMyVoice and let us know your thoughts on what you've heard so far. We'll see you in 3 minutes.
Follow us on Twitter for more great ideas at Voice America Empowerment.
When is the last time you saw sparkles of life in your day? Each day holds a treasure, the extra in the ordinary. It is too easy to miss them because they're familiar and we take them for granted. If you want to add sparkle to your day, listen to Mighty Gems, spotlighting everyday jewels with Dee Lee. She offers a new way to view the world and to discover your own mighty gems in daily life. Listen Fridays at 11 a.m. Pacific Time, 2 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Empowerment Channel.
If you're a free thinker, a seeker of truth, and a lover of stimulating literature, then you will find all that you need in just one powerful book, The God Behind the God, the second book by critically acclaimed author Arian Herbert. Many are saying that this new book is absolutely outstanding, thought-provoking, even mind-blowing. Get your copy of The God Behind the God now on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Chapters Indigo, or visit thegodbehindthegod.com. Seek within until you discover
The God Behind the God.
Friend us on Facebook to keep up with what's empowering the world. Voice America Empowerment.
You are listening to Abuse Survival Stories presents I Reclaim My Voice. To reach our show today, please call in to 1-888-346-9141. Again, that's 1-888-346-9141. You may also send an email to radio at abusesurvivalstories.com. Now, back to our show.
Welcome back. We're here talking with Jeff Pereira from the White Ribbon Campaign. Jeff, we were just discussing the violent language and lifestyle that so many men are immersed in. What about the other men who are fighting the good fight, who are pro-peace and pro-gender equality? How can those men support survivors of violence?
That's a great question. I think what the first thing we can do is listen. I think more than anything, I have a really quick story that kind of elaborates on this. So a friend of mine shared that a male friend of his, who's a big, physically big man, was in an elevator one day in a parking lot. And he's in the elevator by himself, and the elevator door is open, and there's a woman outside of the elevator doors. And the woman looks at him and says, "Excuse me, do you mind if you could get off the elevator so I can get on? I need to feel safe, and I would feel safer if you got off the elevator so I could get on." And this young man, without missing a beat, said, "Absolutely," you know. And there's people who would look at that story and say, "Well, you know, she needs to move on, or she needs that's unrealistic, and it's not fair to him." And I would have said something. And I appreciate everyone's responses, but I think the first question that I want men to think about is, what has she gone through that she has to ask that question? Mm-hmm. You know, what has happened in her life that she that it's you know, and it's. We can discuss and debate things, ways and approaches to the situation, but I think the first thing is to think about, what has she endured? What are women and girls going through? So I think part of that is for men is to open our eyes and our ears and our hearts and listen to these stories that are around us. You know, ask your partner, if you're in a heterosexual relationship, you might not even realize the harassment she gets just walking home from work every day. Mm-hmm. And she comes home and, you know, you share a meal together and you don't even realize what she's endured in her daily walk. So I think for men, it's to really start by listening and thinking about what they're going through and listening for cues. And women have been and continue to be leaders in this work to make a difference around gender-based violence. So it's following their cue and following this path they've created. And then it's taking that conversation back to spaces where men and boys navigate. So taking it back to the locker room, to the bedroom, the boardroom, the kitchen table, where you go to school, where you hang out, where you work, and talking to other guys, you know, and just helping them become aware of this stuff in your own way. And then it's thinking about more ways that you can role model positive behavior, right? And that's whether you're a father or a father figure, an educator, a friend, you're a big brother or a guy that the kids in your apartment building look up to. You can make such a huge impact by doing little things. We have a project called Make the Call, which is with a football team in Toronto called the Toronto Argonauts. The idea is that we encourage men and young men to consider the little actions that they can take. So the little actions can move mountains around these issues. So it's the things you say at the house party, in the locker room, you know, when someone says something. Those can make a big difference. Right. In lives. So that's what we're trying to do, is encourage guys to think about the roles they can play.
Yeah, and I think people are always trying to think of the grand gestures they can do, not always realizing how little it often takes to make a huge difference. So as you know, our Abuse Survival Stories events, we cater to both men and women. And there was a speaker that we had named Coco Lorraine who said something that I will always hold in my heart. And she said, "Men are not the problem. Abuse is the problem." And I love that. And earlier you mentioned that, you know, there's violence that men face. So can you talk about that a bit, Jeff?
Absolutely. And I think one of the things is that, you know, the statistics tell us that 1 out of 6 men have experienced a form of sexual violence. And part of the, again, this idea of being a man is not showing weakness. So the stigma for men in so many different cultures and communities to talk about something they're going through, whether it's mental wellness issues, physical health issues, like guys won't go to the doctor, right? And the other thing is how men won't talk about something that's happened around a sexual nature, if it's a violent harassment or et cetera. Because we're taught that we're supposed to like that, you know, or whatever it is. And so men are afraid to talk about these experiences, so it becomes even much more problematic, you know, where men who have survived and experienced abuse, we need to support them as well and recognize that, you know, while men, you know, not all men are violent or abusive, most men are not doing enough around this issue, you know, and they can listen more and do more. And part of that is also being there for their fellow, you know, male colleagues or friends, loved ones, family members, if they've experienced violence, right? Being a safer space for them as well. Too many times we crack jokes and laugh about these things and these experiences, yes. But there are men who are going through a lot, and we can do more around this piece. So I think it's recognizing that it's a conversation that affects all of us, and like you said, and that was just shared so beautifully, that abuse is the enemy and is the problem, right?
Yes.
And we need to come together around this.
Yes.
And speaking of the conversations, what sort of conversations do you think that men need to have in order for us to see the positive change take place?
I think it's, you know, it's first of all, creating permission to have the conversation amongst ourselves. Like, it's okay to talk about this. You know, it's okay to talk in general. I think it's so hard to get men to open up. So many men in our lives are like islands, you know, like whether it's your father or your partner or a brother or a coworker, they're like an island. That they're so distant and so far, and they're standing right next to you. And I think it's creating space where they can kind of come to you and open up and say it's okay. And part of that can be by role modeling it, by being vulnerable. You know, a good friend of mine is a spoken word artist from New York, Carlos Andres Gomez, and Carlos and I talk a lot about this, about sharing our personal stories and being vulnerable and in role modeling that. Because when you see that, like, we're not performing to be the tough guy or the badass or having all the answers. When you see someone role modeling that, then it becomes, oh, okay, we can talk about this. And this armor we put on as guys, this performance for each other, you know, whatever you want to call it, the alpha male, the man, whatever, that all comes down, and then I can just be myself. Mm-hmm. And it's beautiful. It's beautiful to be in a space where men discover that and cherish that. And we need to create that for ourselves as men, as brothers, to look out for each other, and in turn,
yes,
role modeling that in our interactions with women and girls.
Yes. I love that. So can you tell us about the work that White Ribbon is doing to help end gender-based violence?
Absolutely. Well, you know, we started in Canada over 20 years ago, and it was 3 gentlemen who got together and started cutting out ribbons and handing them out. And now we're in over 60 countries, and by that we mean it's a grassroots effort. So people start their own initiatives. You know, in places like Australia, Brazil, and the UK, there are elaborate organizations. But in a lot of spaces, it's people that will start a coalition or a group, and they spread the message. And the White Ribbon message is to pledge to never commit, condone, or remain silent about violence against women and girls, and saying our future has no violence. And so what we do at White Ribbon here is we role model different ways that men can do these certain things by creating initiatives, programs, educational projects that people can turn to get some information and learn more. You know, so for example, we've partnered with a group here in Ontario called Draw the Line, which encourages men to think about what they can do to draw the line in a situation. So if they see someone in a situation, what are you going to do? So it's a call to action. And so whether it's this initiative or, again, our It Starts With You, It Stays With Him initiative at itstartswithyou.ca, it's free tips and tools on how to be that role model to the son in your life, if you're a coach, if you're a mentor, how to talk about healthy relationships and consent. Mm-hmm. You know, these are big conversations, you know, and consent is a big one, and we need to talk about, you know, why we want what we want as men. You know, why do we do what we do, and are we doing it for ourselves? And when it comes to consent, it's how we interact and navigate life speaking in the language of consent, you know, with everyone around us and ourselves. And these are the things that our programs look to teach and role model. So you can find out more about that online and, you know, do the work that you're doing and continue to do and use some of our tips and tools and consider starting a White Ribbon where you work, live, study, worship, and be part of change.
Absolutely. Now, we've talked about the organization, and I want to talk about you a little bit, Jeff. I've had the pleasure of working with you many times, and one thing I can definitely say, aside from being an absolutely brilliant speaker and messenger, you are a very humble person. So I'd like to talk about the person, Jeff, instead of, you know, getting deflected as I usually do. So I see you at so many events all over Toronto, and I know you do it all over Canada and perhaps beyond, any day of the week, any given time, constantly representing White Ribbon's message. Why did you choose this line of work, and why are you so passionate about it?
You know, I grew up in a home where my father was physically abusive towards my mom. Some of my earliest memories are that, of seeing my mom physically bruised and impacted. And I grew up in a home where I didn't directly experience violence, but as someone who saw it at a very early age, I know what that's like to feel the energy of someone who's angry and to know that something is about to happen. As not a survivor myself, but I can relate on some level and I have some understanding of that. And for me as well, growing up, I had trouble trusting men and believing in men. And it became a thing where I wanted to reclaim that and say that, no, being a man is a good thing. And through my teen years, I rebelled against ideas of manhood and also struggled with embracing it, right? So toxic ideas that, you know, being disrespectful towards women or being the man or being violent to have respect, you know, I knew that these weren't ways that it could be different. And for me, my life has always been around that, about embracing, as I look back, embracing ways to kind of shatter the idea of what a man can be and rewrite the script and flip it and say that being a man can be all these amazing, beautiful things. It's about strength, but it's about a new idea of strength, you know, that's at the love is at the root of it. And so for me growing up, it was a journey to this work that led me here, that helped me recognize that in doing some of my own self-healing and addressing my own problems, I'm addressing the root cause for so many problems around the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, violence against the planet, violence against women, violence against so many different people. Comes from this toxic idea of what it means to be a man. And so it's my personal journey to say, you know what, we can make a difference around this. And it's helped me so much. And, you know, I think it's just about trying to do better, you know. And I'm sure you've heard me share this Maya Angelou quote that I love. It's do the best you can until you know better. Then when you know better, do better. So I'm learning and I'm listening and I'm trying to do better, and I want to role model that to my brothers, that we can do better, you know, and I'm trying myself. I'm far from perfect, but I'm trying every day to do better and be better. So.
Amazing. And that's, again, so humble, with such an amazing answer. And I didn't know that about you. I didn't know what led you to doing this work. And I think that's an amazing journey that you're on. And as you reflect on the work that you have done and all the talks and all the schools that you've gone into, or, you know, any moment during this work, was there any one experience that sort of took your breath away, whether it be in a negative way or a positive way?
Well, I think, you know, there was that moment that I talked about in my TEDx talk, where I talk about being in these schools where violence happens days after a major shooting here in Toronto at our shopping mall, And it was this one experience where I was in a school talking to a group of grade 6 students, and as I was leaving with my friend who's their teacher, there was a lockdown drill exercise that was happening. And I was in the hallway with a group of grade 1 students. So we all kind of went and did the drill, and they knew the drill. We all went into the nearest room, in this case was the music room, and all these little grade ones, and you can imagine grade one students are you know, rowdy and loud and beautifully, just beautiful in their hyper energy. Mm. They silently went single file under this table and sat with their arms and legs crossed, and it felt like it was an eternity, but it was about 10 minutes sitting there in silence, in the dark. Mm-hmm. As the principal walked around the room, mimicking being a shooter and checking if all the doors were locked, and that's the world we live in. You know, that's the world we live in. And I think of these grade one students, like, do they even understand what this is? And I'm like, of course they do, because this is their reality. And I think that we need to become recognize this is a conversation of us. It's not us against them. We're all in this big shoebox that is the world, right? We live in this box together, and we need to make it a beautiful garden for all of us. And that was the moment that really stood with me, and it still stays with me, because I want us to all be able to achieve our dreams and be who we're destined to be. And when we have these limits and rules as far as gender, how it impacts all of us, and so we can change that. So let's do it.
Wow. And finally, Jeff, before we wrap up the segment, one question we like to ask all of our guests is, what would you say was the moment you reclaimed your voice?
Wow. The moment I reclaimed my voice is when I recognized that I had something to say. You know, it's I was very fortunate through my teen years and in my young adult years to recognize that I'm able to tell stories and craft stories, but I realized that there's something I can do with this ability. You know, it's that I can share something that's meaningful and make an impact. So if you have a chance to do something, do something. You know, do something. I want to make an impact and recognize that we all make an impact, but I want to embrace it and make it a positive one. So the moment that I realized I have a voice, like, we all have voices, but I have a voice and I can do something with it.
Yes.
So that was the moment for me.
Amazing.
Definitely. Oh, Jeff, thank you so much for being on our show. You're simply amazing. We just appreciate all the work that you're doing. Please continue. And to our listeners, you can reach Jeff on Twitter at Jeff Pereira, and that's JeffPerera, or on the following websites, whiteribbon.ca, whatmakesaman.org, and higherunlearning.com. Right now, we are heading into a break, and when we come back, we'll be talking with Glenn Canning, father of Rataya Parsons. We'll see you in 3 minutes.
Friend us on Facebook to keep up with what's empowering the world. Voice America Empowerment.
Abuse is an epidemic that thrives on silence. It's time to reclaim our voices. Abuse Survival Stories is an event series which celebrates men and women who have experienced various forms of abuse while providing them with a platform to share their stories and help shatter the silence on which abuse thrives. Featuring raw survival testimonials, powerful spoken word poetry, and creative expression exercises. Abuse Survival Stories is a positive experience which uplifts both the mind and the soul. If you are interested in bringing an Abuse Survival Stories event to your city, please contact us at radio@abusesurvivalstories.com, and let's put an end to suffering in silence.
If you're a free thinker, a seeker of truth, and a lover of stimulating literature, then you will find all that you need in just one powerful book, The God Behind the God, the second book by critically acclaimed author Arian Herbert. Many are saying that this new book is absolutely outstanding, thought-provoking, even mind-blowing. Get your copy of The God Behind the God now on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and Chapters Indigo, or visit thegodbehindthegod.com. Seek within until you discover
The God Behind the God.
We're on Facebook, along with some of the greatest minds of the world, and that includes you. Visit us on Facebook at Voice America Empowerment.
You are listening to Abuse Survival Stories presents I Reclaim My Voice. To reach our show today, please call in to 1-888-346-9141. Again, that's 1-888-346-9141. You may also send an email to radio@abusesurvivalstories.com. Now, back to our show.
Welcome back. Joining us now is Glenn Canning, the father of Rehtaeh Parsons. To give you some background information if you're unfamiliar with Rehtaeh's story, Rehtaeh was raped by four boys when she was 15 years old, one of whom took a photograph during the rape and started sharing it around their school and the community. This led to Rehtaeh being harassed, it led to cyber harassment, and it got so bad that eventually Rehtaeh had to move to another community. Police officers claimed that there was a lack of evidence and would not be pressing charges against the four boys, even though none of the four boys were interviewed during the initial investigation, nor were their cell phones seized for evidence. The distribution of the photograph was dismissed as being a community matter. On April 4th, 2013, after continued harassment and bullying, Rehtaeh Parsons took her own life at the age of 17. Since her death, her father Glenn has been an advocate for her and other victims of sexual violence, as well as victims of cyber harassment. Glenn, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
First off, we just want to commend you on the amazing and important work that you're doing to help so many people. The show is a platform for those who have experienced trauma and abuse to share their personal stories and feelings. And so I want to ask you, as a father, can you provide some insight into what it was like to watch your child deal with the effects of the sexual assault and the harassment that ensued thereafter?
Yeah, as a father, you know, you have a role as a man, and it's a role you think you're supposed to play, but I don't think there's very many men who would know how to play a role of a father whose daughter was raped. I just don't think it's something that men ever think about, that will ever happen to them or they have to experience. And I remember, you know, the night that I was on the phone with Rehtaeh after she had told her mother this, that she was assaulted. And you know, she came on the phone and I just told her that I love her and that it was going to be okay, that we'll get through this, you know. She was extremely distraught and emotionally upset. And I will tell you, and just to be honest, I had absolutely no idea what role I was supposed to do, what role I was supposed to take. I was just completely blindsided and I was just left in the dark. I had no idea what I was supposed to do. And, of course, you support your daughter. You love her very much, and you want what's best for her. And there's all these men, you know. I hear stories all the time. If this ever happened to my daughter, you know, I'd be out there, and I'd be killing them, and I'd be violent. And I really don't think that's what my daughter needed. I don't think that's what any victim would need out of their father, to do something that is going to make sure, basically, that you're not going to be there when they need you. And the reaction, those kind of reactions, I think, are more about the man than about the victim, right? You know, that's what you think you need to do as a man, but what do you think you need to do for your child? Mm-hmm. And I was in the car with Rehtaeh one day, and we were just driving, and it just came over me, and I told her I needed to be honest, and I told her I have no idea what I'm supposed to do. Mm-hmm. I haven't got a clue. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to say. I don't know what to feel. I don't know what she wants from me. And that was the best thing that I could have done, I think, because, you know, it gave her some control over my reaction. And mm-hmm. I think that's the best thing that you can do for a victim or a survivor. You know, let her have the control over what's going to happen here in her life and with her family. And she told me she didn't know what the answer to that would be. But it was just a couple of months later when she asked me if I remembered asking that question. I said, yeah, I remember asking the question what I should do. And she said, I want you to just be my dad. Mm-hmm. Because when I'm with you, I feel like my old self. You know, we're going to a movie or we're going shopping or we're going for a walk with some dogs. And she said, I feel like my old self when I'm with you. And then I realized, you know, my most important role for her was to give her an escape, I guess, from everything that was happening around her with her life. And it was hard to do, of course, sometimes, you know, because you get so angry and upset, especially when you start watching her fall apart. Mm-hmm. When it got really, really bad, you know, it was the most god-awful thing you can imagine, you know, walking into your daughter's bedroom and seeing that she's got blood up her arms and on her sheets, and she's laying there telling you she just wants to die. There's nothing about fatherhood or any kind of instruction book that'll teach you what you're supposed to do then. You know, you're literally in a state of shock and you're just doing the best you can, but there's no guideline. And I get contacted by men all the time. You know, this happened to my daughter, or this happened to my wife, or this happened to me even. And, you know, even by other women, and what should I do? And man, it's heartbreaking. There's so many hurt people out there, you know. This just ripped me apart. It really did. It changed completely who I am as a man.
Yes. And you know, I'm sure it's not easy to admit as a father and as a guide that you don't know what to do. But in the end, it seems like that honesty helped so much, and that vulnerability helped so much. And you mentioned that, you know, other people are reaching out and asking you, and there are not a lot of resources out there for, although there are resources for people who are experiencing the violence firsthand, there's not a lot of resources for family members on how they can support loved ones going through these incidents and these situations. Do you have anything to offer for anyone who might be looking for those sorts of answers on how they can help?
I would say, the most important thing I did was let Ritea have control over what it was I was going to do, and what role I was going to play in her life now, you know. And even though she wanted that, it was good. But the other role I played, of course, was support, you know, supporting father, supporting parent, where we let her know right away if she has any kind of counseling or therapy that she needs, or medical appointment she needs to go to, you know. Absolutely. You know, we're right there all over that. Let's get you there and get you home and everything. And we never pushed her on it because, you know, I think when this happened to somebody, when it does happen to people, it's the loss it's like a control issue where, you know, something happened to them they had no say in. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, obviously that's very, very traumatizing, but for people in your life that love you, they need to understand that they need to step back and make sure that that person is what comes first. So their interests come first. Their emotions come first. You know, their needs and wants and everything come first. You can't push people into this is what you need to do and try to push them into it. Mm-hmm. And I think there are parents out there who try to do that. Well, I'll get you into therapy and you're going to your appointment and you're confused and angry and everything like this. So we're doing this. And I don't think that's the right response. I think it has to work for the victim. And in the end with Rite, you know, it was, she went to a few different therapists. Some of them didn't work out. But in the very end, the night before she died, before she decided to end her life, I actually drove her home from a therapy session, and she was telling me how wonderful this lady was and how much she thought of her, you know, and she was saying that this is, great, I made my own appointment, and she never really did that before. You know, actually made her follow-up appointment with somebody to talk about where she is in her life and how she's dealing with her anger and everything. And she seemed like a completely different person to me when we were driving home that night. You know, she was telling me about that she's looking for a job. She's got good resumes made up. I even helped her with that stuff. And you know, it was just hard to deal with, I guess, in a way, because she was going home from a therapist session that actually seemed to really work for her. She was really happy about it, but it was the next evening when she hung herself.
So, Glenn, so many people understandably find it difficult to discuss the tragedies they've experienced. Why have you chosen to do this work, which often requires you to revisit the details of your daughter's death, you know, over and over?
You know, right after Rite died, I quite literally like wanted to just shut down, close the doors, draw the blinds, and just disappear. And I really wanted to do that. And I know her mom went out in the community because she wrote something on Facebook that was just exploding. And my phone was ringing off the hook, and emails were just piling up. And it was an incredible and I ignored it for like 2 or 3 days, and then I had the television on one day, and I've seen like hundreds of people downtown Halifax in our city of Halifax holding up pictures of my daughter. You know, and then it just came over me that I can't let this, I can't let her die off like that. I can't let her memory end. I what happened was just so unbelievably wrong. You know, and you do your best to try to make it right. Mm-hmm. You make mistakes along the way. You definitely make a lot of people angry, believe me. Mm-hmm. It can be very frustrating. You know, I noticed that when you tweeted about me today, of course, there's someone on there responding that, you know, trolling you, and that's just the unbelievable stuff that happens. But it comes really along, I guess, with being an online presence. And people warned me right at the very start, if I stand up about violence against women and I speak out about sexual assault, there will be people who will hate me. And mm-hmm. and incredibly, and as sad as that is the absolute truth. And it's disgusting. It really, truly is. But you know what? I'm not doing this for those people. Those people are why this stuff happens in the first place, and mm-hmm. I'm not interested in what they have to say. I ignore it completely, and I just move on and carry on and hope that I'm making a difference. And I believe that Rutea's story has made a difference.
Absolutely. We have just about half a minute right now before we have to close. But, you know, there's so much focus on the end of Rutea's life, and we don't want that to take away from who she was when she was alive. So can you just share one thing about her that really, you know, really you would want everyone to know about your daughter?
Yeah, my daughter, from the time she could walk right up until she, her life ended. Whenever I would out be in a park or downtown with her, we'd go see a movie or anything like this or at all, whenever she saw somebody who was homeless or asking for money, she would always turn around and ask me if I had changed so she could go over and give it to them. She did it right from the very start. She had a very compassionate heart. She was a beautiful, lovely little girl. You know, it's just a terrible loss. I ended up learning a lot more about life from her than anything else has ever taught me.
We appreciate you joining us on the show today, Glenn, and we wish you so much success, positive impact, and healing with the work that you're doing.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you. To our listeners, if you'd like to contact Glenn, you can check out his website at glenncanning.com. That's glenncanning.com. For more information on the Rutea Parsons Society, which helps prevent sexual assault and cyber harassment, visit ruteaparsons.ca. Also, we just posted Jeff Pereira's talk, The Ladder of Manhood, on our Abuse Survival Stories Facebook page. So check that out when you have a chance. Thank you all very much for tuning in today. Be sure to visit us on our website at abusesurvivalstories.com for pictures and videos of the work that we're doing. You can also find the links to our past shows on our host page on voiceamerica.com. We'd love to hear what you thought about the show, so shoot us an email at radio@abusesurvivalstories.com. You've been listening to Abuse Survival Stories presents I Reclaim My Voice. I'm your host, Reese Zigazaga.
And I'm your co-host, Denise. Before we leave, you will be hearing a poem from Mr. Om Shanti called Circles. If you'd like to contact Om Shanti on Facebook, you can reach him under Om Shanti, and it's OHMSHANTI. As we close off our show today, our wish for you at Abuse Survival Stories is that you will embrace the perfect imperfections that make you uniquely you and know that you are enough. We hope that you enjoy the poem and that you will join us again next week.
Circles is all she ever wanted to see. Squares were too cornered. She hated corners because that's where the memories were. So she wanted circles because at least she can continue coming back to places she was familiar with without having to feel cornered. You can abuse slavery when you depend on it. It can be the reason you do and the motivation not to. Even in her circles, it still cornered her. The feeling of no definite endpoint, the content in the familiar. Circumstances happen so you realize what your stance is. When the comforts in your circle lose pillows and trade blankets for reminders of how asleep awake is, you toss and turn from the nightmares that have dreamt you, and you wish you could sleep with them and have babies that birth you. See, it just doesn't make sense. She loved circles because she works 360 and takes 5 days to miss time. I'd ask her when she really lives. Abuse is like having sheep lead shepherds. But why would I think that's even a bad thing? Because the power wasn't given to its perceived owner? In circles, she has had no power, but somehow she's still able to give it. I'd also ask her what she thinks that means. I've told her many times that marrying divorce only brings counterproducts. It's all that's in store. But she loves the discounts the merchant gives to his only customer. She's willing to pay the price. But when the timer goes off, and it's time for the ingredients to touch tongues, and their expression forgets how to express, it's easy to see that their love for the taste is made up. You're a real man with the heart of an imaginary character. So what does it really beat for? You would trade simple moments of happiness for complex apartments you'd never get the keys to because of simple numbers you can't count on. Far is too close, and close is always too far. The sky always looks at you, and you never look into the sky. That will cause you to stretch your throat and massage some words that will speak volumes too loud for small speakers. This explains the men in her circle that blame their lack of energy on love. They claim it makes them weak and unable to think for themselves. I met her on her journey to no end and gave her a reason to trust corners. The beauty of having such a view, of seeing everything in the corner with her back up against nothing but no one. What if I told you you were a great creation and your very existence is what sustains existence? Why wouldn't you exit then? When pain from back then always comes packaged in the present, how do I tell you that that's not the gift of life? When you piece together the pieces of your mind, you will realize the pieces were never separated. And that unity is where peace is.
Thank you again for tuning in to the program this week. Abuse Survival Stories presents I Reclaim My Voice with co-hosts Reese Zigazaga and Denise Watkus can be heard live every Thursday at 5 p.m. Pacific Time, 8 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Empowerment Channel. Please join us again next week.